Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. With home prices and interest rates dropping, buyers should be storming the gates, right? But they're sitting in their one-bedroom rentals, not even trying.
There are a number of first-time home buyers that would love to take advantage of this market, but their perception is they don't qualify.
Federal housing loans can put a mortgage within reach. Meanwhile, with so many companies going under these days, you might start to wonder about your job security and all that money you've stashed in your 401k.
Employers cannot touch that money if they become bankrupt. If they need the money, they can't touch it. It's your money.
And have you heard the one about the bad bank?
The family with a crazy old uncle. This old uncle is giving them problems, so they take him and they put him in an asylum.
We'll explain as we continue our coverage of fallout from the financial crisis on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. This week, President Barack Obama called the recession a continuing disaster for American families. This week, we'll look at several facets of that disaster. More laid-off workers are finding out the high price of COBRA health care. Others are wondering what happens to their health care and retirement funds if their company goes bankrupt. And then there's still that housing mess. New home sales fell yet again last month despite super low interest rates. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers.
We start today with housing. The median price of a new home sold last month was just over $200,000. That's down almost 10% from a year ago. So it's a great time to buy, right? Long as you have a high credit score and a big down payment, you're golden. If you don't have either of those, well, conventional wisdom says you're out of luck. But our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has a three-letter rejoinder, FHA.
It's true the subprime loan is deader than the proverbial doornail upon which many a foreclosure notice hangs these days, which leads a lot of would-be homebuyers to think they missed their chance. Well, that has New Hampshire real estate broker Fred Doliak singing the blues.
A number of first-time home buyers would love to take advantage of this market, but their perception is they don't qualify.
Oh, baby, don't you know? I know the lowdown.
With a nod to B.B. King, Doliak thinks prospective home buyers need to know the lowdown on finding a low-down payment loan.
You can buy a house with 3.5% down and with a credit score of roughly 600, which is, you know, not considered to be stellar credit.
Doliak says those loans are still available thanks to the granddaddy of subprime lending, the Federal Housing Administration. It was created to spur new lending in the depths of the Great Depression by insuring against mortgage defaults. Just 3 years ago, hardly anybody bothered with the FHA since loans were so easy to find. It insured less than 2% of all home purchase loans. But now, what made sense during the Depression is back in demand. Syndicated real estate columnist Peter G. Miller publishes OurBroker.com.
We have estimates which suggest that in the coming year, FHA loans will be roughly about 30% of all mortgage originations, and also that the total amount of these loans will be about $440 billion.
Miller says the FHA doesn't actually offer mortgages itself. It insures loans made by FHA-approved lenders. To qualify, you'll need proof you can afford to repay the loan. And since this loan protection program is self-supporting, expect to pay both a sizable upfront fee and a little extra each month.
It's like any other form of insurance. You pay a premium. And that's really what the trade is. Less upfront, but you got to pay a premium.
These FHA-insured loans aren't just for first-time homebuyers. Miller says even current homeowners, as long as they haven't fallen behind in their payments, might do better refinancing under FHA terms.
Individuals who have toxic loans, these are loans where they're going to owe more money, they're going to have much bigger payments. If they can refinance into an FHA loan, they're going to be far ahead, and most likely, they'll avoid foreclosure.
There are limits on the size of the loans the FHA will insure, caps that differ from place to place based upon the average income in a particular area. But Kevin Weaver, the national FHA manager for Emory Federal Credit Union, says most homes can qualify.
I would not consider them to be for low-end buyers only. I've had people purchase 400, 500 even $600,000 homes using FHA financing in the last year.
You might find better terms using private mortgage insurance to lower the down payment on a cheaper conventional loan. But Weaver says these days you'll need cream-of-the-crop credit to qualify for those.
The mortgage insurance companies have actually placed a stranglehold on the lending industry in a lot of markets around the country. Without FHA, these markets can't recover.
But with FHA, New Hampshire broker Fred Doliak is hopeful home sales everywhere just might pick up.
If we get the first-time home buyer buying, then the whole real estate market starts to filter up. And you put a lot of people back to work, you start selling a lot of goods and services, and you haven't spent a dime of taxpayer money to stimulate the economy.
Provided, he says, that enough buyers start getting the low down. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. By FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor. Online at finrafoundation.org. And by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle. The antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com.
Here's one area of the mortgage market that's seeing some action. Federally insured reverse mortgage applications are up 14% last year, and most of those are getting approved. Reverse mortgages are for people who are 62 years old or older. They're designed to make the mortgage get bigger as they fill up the homeowner's pockets with cash. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has that story.
Kate Love is a loan originator outside Seattle. She used to get people into forward mortgages, but as she puts it,
2007 was an interesting year to be a loan originator.
You can translate interesting to disastrous. So Love was looking for a part of the mortgage market that was a bit more stable. She found it selling reverse mortgages for a company appropriately named Stay in Home. Reverse mortgages are loans that are aimed at cash-strapped older homeowners.
You know, in this day and age where everyone's facing economic hardship, seniors are having a rougher time, in my opinion, than those of us who can still work. And so it's been a growth market.
Essentially, reverse mortgages allow seniors to use the value of their house as an ATM. To explain how it works, here's a potential customer. He's 67, lives in Wichita, Kansas with his wife, has no children, and, well, I'll let him introduce himself.
Okay, it's Sam Connect, first name Sam, last name K-N-E-C-H-T. I usually say my parents were poor and couldn't afford to buy more than one vowel.
They could afford to buy a house, though, and Sam inherited it after they died. It's a ranch house worth about $150,000. He owes about $70,000 on the house and pays about $800 a month.
And it looked like it'd be a good idea to supplement our retirement income by eliminating our mortgage payments.
So Connect shopped around for a reverse mortgage. In exchange for an upfront fee and a modest interest rate, a reverse mortgage lender would let him increase the debt on his house to free up some cash. That would pay down his forward mortgage and allow him to do some traveling. The money would be paid back to the bank when the house is sold.
We expect to spend our last dollar on her last day.
Connect, or more importantly, the lender, wouldn't have to worry about the value of the home decreasing and the mortgage going upside down. That's because almost all reverse mortgages are insured by the Federal Housing Administration. With that kind of safety net, it's no wonder banks are still offering reverse mortgages. But are they a good fit for everyone? I asked David Sertner of the AARP.
Well, it's generally a good fit for somebody who is what we might call as home rich but cash poor.
Sertner says an increasing number of seniors are finding themselves in that position. The value of 401ks have plummeted in recent months, and retirees are living longer.
Roughly one out of every three retirees is living almost entirely on Social Security alone, 90% or more of their income coming from Social Security.
But Sertner says there are drawbacks to reverse mortgages. Right now, those federally insured loans can only assign a maximum value of $417,000 to your house. And reverse mortgages have high closing costs, including fees to the FHA in exchange for that federal insurance. He warns seniors to beware of loan originators who may try to get you to use the money from the house to buy a product you don't need. But for the most part, he says, reverse mortgages are safe and may become more common as an increasing number of Americans retire without enough money to live on. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's time for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story. And with me once again this week is our good friend and economics editor, Chris Farrell. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing well. You had a good week?
I have had a good week. But, you know, I keep hearing this phrase over and over that everything is going to change coming out of this financial crisis, that our financial world is going to look completely different, that we are tossing out all of the old rules. I have my doubts that this is actually going to happen. What do you think?
Oh, and I agree with you, Tess. There are some unprecedented things going on. Wall Street has disappeared. We're talking about the nationalization of the banking system. But when it comes to our personal finances, you know, a lot of these rules came about because of depressions and recessions. You want to talk to the best financial planner in the world? Go back to 5th century BC Aristotle and the golden mean. Not going to the extremes is still the best personal finance advice anyone can give. We need to relearn these lessons, and I guess they're very hard to learn, but this is why you go back to the basics such as diversification, so you don't get caught up in the moment.
But let me ask you, this notion of diversification, even people who were diversified are getting slammed or have been over the last 6 to 8 months. It seems like there are a lot of rules that we've all been taught, both on this show and elsewhere, that didn't work. So when we talk about this notion of tossing out all the old rules, should we be, or should we trust that those rules will get us through this?
Diversification doesn't work over a short period of time, 6 months to a year. But if you look at your portfolio tests, I'm willing to bet your government bond portfolio or your bond portfolio didn't do all that bad. It's actually minimized your losses. It hasn't prevented you from having losses, but it's minimized your losses.
But Chris, what are we supposed to make of, you know, you go to the bookstore and compare the headlines today about personal finance on these books to even a year ago. All of the advice seems to have completely shifted in a matter of 12 months. So who are you supposed to believe?
This is one of the things, and I know I'm repeating myself, why I like things about diversification, dollar cost averaging. They keep you between two extremes. The extreme of, hey, it's all going to work out. Markets always go up. Well, come on, that's ridiculous. And at the same time, you can't live in a bunker. People who have invested in the markets have gotten wealthier. So you want to go down the middle. And what you've highlighted are the extremes. When it's bad, we get lots of information about bad times. When it's good, we get lots of information saying the good times are going to last forever. Hello, they don't.
Okay, people, no bunkers. Remember the golden mean. Thanks so much, Chris, and we'll talk to you later in the show.
Thanks, Tess. It's always fun to have these conversations.
Cobras can be scary, especially when they cost you thousands of dollars every month.
And we thought we might have to do it short term, just found that we couldn't get health care anywhere else.
Once bitten, twice shy, a look at Cobra health insurance coverage. It's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. As fallout continues from the economic crisis, the House passed its version of a stimulus package this week. $819 billion in spending on infrastructure and tax cuts and on and on. Also buried in the 647-page bill, an expansion of COBRA health care coverage. If you've ever left a job, you've heard of COBRA. You get to keep your health care plan, but you also get to pay for it. The new provision would require employers to offer COBRA for at least a decade instead of the current 18 months. But as Sally Herships reports, COBRA's financial bite is enough to make anyone sick.
Andrew Garda is taking a risk, a big one. The cost of his family's health insurance was too much to bear, So Garda and his wife Melina opted to leave their kids uncovered for 3 months. Garda says after that, their two sons can qualify for health care from the state of California. Now, no one in the family is covered.
I'm making a choice for myself. My wife's making a choice for herself, and that's one thing. But, you know, we're talking about our kids, and that's a choice we have to make for them, and that's kind of scary.
What's your favorite ornament?
My favorite ornament is the...
Garda worked at an animation company in Los Angeles. About a year ago, the production he was on wrapped up.
When I first left my job, you know, my wife was making significantly good money.
So Garda decided to stay home with the kids and try his hand at writing. But because his wife Melina was a freelancer, they were on their own when it came to health care.
We ended up having to go with Cobra, and we thought we might have to do it short term, just found that we couldn't get health care anywhere else.
The Gardas have pre-existing conditions. Their younger son had recently fractured his skull. Melina has chronic back problems. No private company wanted to cover them. They had no choice but Cobra.
I was happy that we had it because I think we were coming off of being rejected by healthcare providers and we're just like, well, at least we know that our kids can be covered.
Footing the bill for healthcare costs without help from an employer can be a shock. But it's an issue a lot of families are facing right now, and one the Gardas thought they had under control.
When we first started, it was affordable, if you can call $1,500 a month affordable.
Then Melina got laid off, and Andrew couldn't find work. Their savings were gone quickly.
Occasionally it was pay for Cobra and pay other bills late. You start really wondering where you're ranking your health care as a necessity.
The Gardas were forced to choose between paying for Cobra and keeping the lights on in their home.
And those are just choices Americans shouldn't have to make.
Sandy Prager is the Kansas State Insurance Commissioner. She also helps the national government regulate insurance and protect consumers. She says there are 45 million Americans without insurance. And even though healthcare is pricey, she says it's important to stay covered.
You know, it doesn't take long to run up a very, very, very high hospital bill, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
But footing the entire bill for your healthcare is expensive, too. And Prager says Cobra is really only meant as a stopgap. But there are alternatives, like state plans for people with chronic medical conditions and private plans that only cover emergencies.
You can go out and find catastrophic coverage for maybe $300, $400 a month.
But it's still a gamble. Prager says the deductibles on these plans are so high, you need to be prepared to fork over thousands. And again, she says, Cobra is only meant as a temporary fix.
So you got to find a job.
You've got to find a job, yeah.
After struggling to keep up with payments, the Gardas are in debt, $13,000. I asked Andrew Garda if Cobra were a medication, what he thought the label might say.
Side effects may include extra cost, draining of bank account, and some hard choices.
Choices like deciding to move. The Gardas are headed from L.A. to Sacramento to live with family. They're hoping the change will remedy their dire economic situation. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
So Cobra is an option for employees who've been laid off. But what happens when the company goes out of business? Corporate bankruptcy rumors and announcements are now part of daily life. This week's rumors involved possible Chapter 11 filings at the Seattle Times and auto parts maker Visteon. Actual announcements came from a Texas ethanol manufacturer, a seafood processor in Alaska, and a Chicago clothier, among others. Kimberly Lankford of Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine joins us to talk about what happens to employee benefits during a bankruptcy. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
We've just heard this story about the Gardas from Sally Herships, and I wonder if there's kind of anything that you wanted to expand on in terms of letting folks know what the options are once they lose a job. There's Cobra, but that's not all, right?
Well, the choices do get difficult if you do have a pre-existing condition. But if you are healthy, many times you can get a much better deal buying a private insurance policy on your own. Especially if you buy a high deductible plan with a health savings account, you get tax benefits. But if you do have a pre-existing condition, your choices are limited.
What we're talking about here is if someone loses their job. But what happens if your company literally goes out of business? There are so many that are declaring bankruptcy now. Are you eligible for Cobra even if a company goes bankrupt?
No. If your company actually stops doing business and discontinues its health insurance plan, then there is no COBRA. You do get a few other options, though. You may be able to sign up for your spouse's plan, even though it's not open enrollment season, or you may have additional protections like continuation policies and other conversion policies that you may be eligible depending on your state.
Are there certain programs that you should keep an eye out for? I know it varies from state to state, but are there, say, you know, children's insurance programs that you should make sure you're looking for as you're doing this research?
Well, that is a great idea. A lot of families who aren't qualified for Medicaid because they earned too much or had too much in assets lose their job and may still be qualified to have their children on the state's health insurance program. So it's definitely something to check out. A website that I really like called coverageforall.org, it spells out all of these things in your state. It talks about the high-risk pools, children's health insurance rules, Medicaid rules, all of these options for people who may have pre-existing conditions or may have lost their job.
Okay, and we'll put links to that site on our website, which is marketplace.org. And what about pensions and other retirement benefits? If your company goes under, what protections are there for that money that either you have set aside or has been set aside for you?
Well, there is the Pension Benefit Guarantee Association, and they are really coming into play when a lot of these companies are going bankrupt. If the money that the company had set aside in reserves for pension is not enough to be able to fulfill its obligations, then they end up paying a certain amount in benefits. There's a limited amount, so you may not be able to get all of your benefits. But it's the government agency is there to make sure that you still do get some pension payouts, even if the reserves the company set aside can't afford to cover it.
Well, how is that determined, whether companies either get to dip into the PBGC or aren't allowed to?
Well, so much of it depends on what the bankruptcy court decides. If the bankruptcy court decides that the company cannot pay its obligation, or if it shuts down entirely, then the pension plan will be terminated and the PBGC can help pay the benefits.
And what about if you have a 401k?
401k is actually held in a separate trust. There's a lot of protections there, and employers cannot touch that money if they become bankrupt. If they need the money, they can't touch it. It's your money.
Kimberly Langford is with Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. Thanks so much for coming in and helping us out today.
That's my pleasure.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. By FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor. Online at finrafoundation.org. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
It's time for Getting Personal, that part of the show where we take all your personal finance questions. And with me, once again, is our own expert, Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
And we've got Peter on the phone from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how you doing?
We're doing well. What's your question for Chris today?
My situation is basically I'm in my 20s. I'm going to be returning to school in a few months. I'm currently fully funding a Roth IRA, but I want to try and minimize the amount of loans I take out for, you know, student loans for debt. And I don't want to lose out on, you know, everything's very cheap right now. So I don't really know how to balance this.
So you're currently buying, sounds like, stocks for your Roth IRA.
Yes.
If you stop that to save money for student loans, you're missing out on a bargain. What do you think, Chris?
Boy, I have a couple of reactions here. I mean, obviously, my bias, and particularly in the environment that we're in, is to take on as little debt as possible. Boy, putting money into a Roth when you're in your 20s, whoa. And one thing we know we can't bring back is time. So I got a couple of thoughts on how to deal with this. One is, if you're going back to school, I assume that you're going to earn more when you come out of the additional schooling.
That's the plan.
So then it's really taking a look, how much of a debt burden are we really talking about relative to your future income?
Okay.
That's one calculation to be looking at. Another calculation is to put the money into the Roth, but not in the stocks, in the cash. Money market mutual fund, certificate of deposit. Because remember, you can withdraw your contributions without penalty. You can't withdraw the earnings, but you can withdraw the contributions. So if it turns out that you don't like the debt situation, you can withdraw some of the money from your Roth and live off of that or just reduce your debt burden. The final point is to make it not an either-or question. Maybe you only make a small contribution this year. You'll borrow less, but you're still making a contribution to the Roth, and that will compound over time. It's not going to be as much, but for only the period of time that you're going to school, as soon as you get out of school, if you're already funding a Roth right now, my guess is you graduate from school the next day, guess what you're going to be doing, or at least the day that you get your job, you'll be fully funding your Roth again.
Exactly. Sounds good.
Well, thanks so much for the call, Peter.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, our next question is an email from Joan Marie in Westfield, Massachusetts, and she and her husband recently adopted twins that had been wards of the state. As wards of the state, they qualify for free tuition at all the state schools and universities. So she wants to know, since in theory their higher education is paid for, should they contribute to 529 plans? There are always school fees and charges and other expenses, of course, aside from tuition. So could you use 529 money toward those?
Right. Here's my basic reaction. Okay, they probably will go to those schools. It's such an enormous benefit. Yeah. And you know, quite frankly, and they're wonderful schools in Massachusetts. So I can't see the penalty there. So let's just make the assumption that they are going to take advantage. And here what I would do is put in a little bit of money. And the reason why I'd put in a little bit of money is twofold. One, you know, saving's hard. So when we segregate money, it makes it a little bit easier. And it'll grow a little bit. I just wouldn't put that much money in there, because if you've got the tuition, room and board, and those are the big things that get covered, then it's, you know, it's your books. One of the hot issues right now in the whole 529 world is laptop computers.
Yep.
Can you pay for them out of the 529 plan? And right now, what it turns out, if the college requires you to have a laptop, which many do, then you can pay for it out of the 529 plan. If the college doesn't, then you can't. That's the rule of thumb we're working with. So I wouldn't put much in there, but I would put a little bit. And part of it is just so that you know the savings are there when they need it, but don't put in much, because what you don't want to do is overfund this plan and then have to pay the penalty.
And that is a question that we actually have gotten before, which is what happens if you save in a 529 and you don't end up using that money either for your child or later on in life for yourself?
Well, that's the big question, because my first answer always is, well, if you don't use it for your child, use it for yourself. There's a lot of growth in community colleges from older workers and senior citizens trying to pick up some new skills. So you can go to a community college with it. But if you don't, you're going to pay taxes plus a 10% penalty on the money.
Okay. Susan wrote in from Houston, Texas, and her daughter and her fiancé, the daughter's fiancé, not Susan's, will soon be graduating from college, and they're going to be teachers. They have all kinds of personal finance issues to consider: emergency fund, paying off student loans, saving for a house. So she's wondering if you have any recommendations for books designed for a young couple just starting out that will help educate them.
I do. And I've looked at a number of the books that are geared toward young people. Hey, dude, want to save some money? I'm not going to recommend that book. But I am going to recommend a book that is simply written and very short. It's called A Random Walk Guide to Investing, 10 Rules for Financial Success by Burton Malkiel.
And this is the guy who wrote A Random Walk Down Wall Street, one of the Bibles of personal investing, right?
Exactly. And that's a much bigger commitment. That takes a lot more time. It deals with a lot more history. The book that I've just mentioned, it just cuts right to the chase. You know, let's make your personal life simple, but you want to be smart with your money because you work hard for it. Here's how you build up your savings over time.
Well, that's all the time we've got for Getting Personal right now, but we'll have more of your questions a little later in the show. And right now I have a special request from all our military servicemen and women out there. Do you have a financial question that you need help solving? Well, we'd like to hear your stories and get your questions. Give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Okay, it is Super Bowl weekend. Cue the beer commercials. You may have heard Miller High Life is in protest mode of sorts. debuting a series of one-second ads in order to avoid the $3 million per 30-second ransom. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we'll meet a different kind of beer company and a beer man who does a lot more watching than drinking.
My name is Luther Paul, and I'm the head brewer here at Lakefront Brewery. Brewing is one of those things that you are dealing with a little monster called yeast, and sometimes he can treat you very well, and other times he doesn't always do what you want him to do. There are schools, there's brewing schools. There's a couple of them in Germany, there's some in Britain, and then the U.S. definitely has a couple of them too. People always ask me if the recipes are secret, and they're not really. And actually, a lot of times, a recipe for beer can be quite simple. It's more where the beer is made, how it's brewed, and the techniques that also go along with that recipe that really kind of make a beer unique. Some days it is a 9-to-5 job, and other days it can go a little bit longer. I guess a typical day, if it's a production day, we always have the brew kettle going. And at the same time, someone's probably actually transferring beer from either a fermentation stage into maybe a storage stage. And then, of course, there's packaging that's going on throughout the day, too. There's a lot of hazards, actually. You're dealing with pressured tanks. You're dealing with a lot of chemicals like caustic soda, which is sodium hydroxide, or acids that are used for cleaning tanks and just general cleaning in the brewery. Another question that I get quite often is, are you always drinking beer? Is that your job? And it is part of my job. I actually go around on a daily basis and am sampling tanks. This doesn't mean I'm drinking pint after pint of beer when I'm doing this. I'm actually taking very small samples and just tasting them and just seeing how beer is coming along. Oh, I don't want to call myself a beer snob because I appreciate the big brewers for what they do, and I'm not afraid to have a Miller at once in a while. If someone offers me one, I'm more than happy to drink it. Yeah. The average salary for a position of mine would be around like $45,000-$50,000. It is a job that I never do get bored with. I'm not exactly sure why that is, but it's always keeps my interest piqued, and it's a fun job as far as making this very unique product that people enjoy very much. It's kind of nice.
That was Luther Paul, the head brewer at Lakefront Brewery in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. A Day in the Work Life was produced by Aaron Scott. You know how awesome it is to find a forgotten fiver in your pants pocket? Well, that goes double or more when you find out something you own is worth a lot of coin.
Suddenly, I was curious about what kind of money I could get for my kitchen table, my bedside lamp, my old Girl Scout uniform.
Vintage values, plus what to look out for this tax season. It's coming up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Don't hate me because I'm done with my taxes. Yeah, finished them last weekend, getting a refund from Uncle Sam, and probably an IOU from the state of California. For those of you who haven't yet gotten all your paperwork together, we've brought in Frank Deegan. He's an enrolled tax agent who's been with us over several tax seasons. Welcome back.
Thanks, Tess. It's good to talk to you again.
You know, 2008 was a pretty terrible year. All kinds of surprises on all kinds of fronts. As we look at getting our taxes done, is there anything that we need to brace ourselves for in terms of this particular season?
Well, this year we hope for a fairly positive filing season. Of course, the economic conditions, we may see some situations we haven't seen in the past, people maybe taking more money out of their 401ks or IRAs and that type of thing.
And that's something that you want to watch for, because if you did that, you're going to get a pretty hefty hit, right?
Yeah, typically, and especially if you're under 59 and a half, you do have to pay a 10% penalty. Unfortunately, just the fact that you were out of work or you needed the money doesn't absolve you of that penalty. Though I will tell your listeners in the Midwest, there are some exceptions to that general rule. So do a little bit of research, or if they have a tax professional, make sure you touch base with them on that.
Is that because of natural disasters that they went through?
Yes, that was because of the severe flooding in the Midwest, and certain counties are affected. So it's something to pay some attention to.
Let's talk about the recovery rebate credit. Now, this has to do with last year's stimulus package. What should folks be looking out for?
What happened was when Congress passed that stimulus package, they authorized, I guess, what we would call a prebate of 2008 taxes. Obviously, they only had the 2007 tax returns to go by, so they gave these stimulus payments based on filing a 2008 return that, you know, is going to be done in the future, but using 2007 numbers. So if you're over a certain amount of money, you may not have qualified. Obviously, with the economic downturn, there may be some people whose gross income is certainly not as high as it was last year. So there is a special line on the tax return where you can calculate that you can get this credit as a result of not being able to take it in 2007.
You know, one question that we got into our inbox here at Marketplace this past week was someone asked whether they should actually hold off doing their taxes until there is a new stimulus package passed by the Congress. You know, they're wondering if that could change their taxes for 2008. Any advice there?
I don't think so. I wouldn't recommend that to my clients. The only possible place I see it is maybe in this first-time home buyer credit. Let me explain that to you, Tess, because a lot of folks have been asking about this. Taxpayers who have certain adjusted gross income limitations are eligible for a $7,500 tax credit for what they call a first-time home buyer, meaning you could not have owned a home in the past 3 years. It is basically a loan that must be repaid back over 15 years, starting with the 2010 tax return. So the taxpayer will get $7,500 now, but based on current law, they will have to pay that back over a 15-year period in $500 increments.
You say that that's based on current law. Sounds like maybe there are some changes in the offing?
There are provisions in the Congress right now that the $7,500 would be forgiven, that the credit would really be a credit. You wouldn't have to pay it back.
Well, we're supposed to have more votes on the stimulus this week, so I guess we'll see what happens. Frank Deegan is an enrolled agent, which means that he is licensed by the IRS itself to represent taxpayers. Thanks so much for your help.
Thank you, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
We're back with more of Getting Personal, and I'm here with Chris Farrell, our personal finance expert. And Chris, we have a young man who is a fan of the show on the line. Morgan is here with us in Los Angeles. Hi, Morgan.
Hello.
How old are you?
I'm 13.
Terrific. And have you saved some money?
I've saved $600.
$600? How did you do that?
Well, I earn $300 a month. I get money. I get $140 from my parents, and I work at a comic book store, and I do dog walking for the other, you know, 160.
Good for you. What's your favorite comic?
The Fantastic Four.
So are you wanting to know maybe from Chris where to put your money?
Yeah.
Well, what do you think, Chris?
Well, part of what I would do with your money is to have some fun with it and do some research and invest in some stocks. And this is not to make money. You may make money. You probably will. If you're already saving at 13, we'll probably all end up working for you in about 10, 20 years. But part of it is the stock market is a fascinating way to learn about our economy, and it affects the way you even look at things. And then the other part is you're more conservative, you know, let's take advantage of your savings so we can build it up over a period of time.
Because if you do that, when you enter the workforce, you'll be so far ahead of so many people.
Morgan, is that something you think you might want to do?
Yeah.
Hey, Morgan, what have you done before as you saved your money? What have you done with it?
I don't know. I just spend it on junk.
Well, we don't want you to do that. Have you bought anything specifically with your money?
Well, I have some silver coins.
Some silver coins?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. What made you go into that investment?
I thought they were interesting.
What was interesting about them?
They were like a good collectible, and there's a Morgan dollar, and I don't know, it's got the same name as me.
Ah, the Morgan silver dollar from Morgan in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
Well, so have you been hanging on to those?
Yeah, they're pretty much the same. I think they're worth, like $100 to like $150 each.
Yeah? All right. Well, thanks for calling in.
Okay, thank you.
And congratulations on starting your money management so young.
Thank you. Thank you both.
All right, Chris, we've got an email from Leo in Greenbelt, Maryland, and it seems he could learn a little from our friend Morgan. He's 55 and a little embarrassed to admit he's done little or no planning for the future. So, Leo, call Morgan. He'll give you a little advice here. But in the meantime, Chris, Leo's 403B is worth less than his yearly gross salary. He lives paycheck to paycheck. He says even though he doesn't live extravagantly, he doesn't have too much debt. For some reason, he never has any money. He's a horrible saver. Yeah, how many of us are in the same boat?
I was just going to say, okay, so there's something unusual here.
Exactly. So here's what he wants to do this year. He wants to work on his emotional relationship with money. He wants to develop an accurate picture of his current financial status and get some help from a financial planner. So his question is, does this seem doable? I would say eminently. Will he be able to reverse years of bad habits? Is there something he's missing?
Okay, a couple things. First of all, this is definitely doable, as you said, Tess. He can do it. And I really like the fact that he used the word reverse years of bad habits, because what that says is we're going to develop some good habits over a period of time. And don't be panic-stricken. You have time on your side still to get your house in order. Couple of quick thoughts. Forget the financial planner. First thing we do, absolutely right, you're going to want to create a budget. And what that means is for a period of 2 to 3 months, truly write down everything. All your bills, all your spending, you see where it's going, and then you can see where the cut. So that's kind of on the budget side.
Mm-hmm.
Second point, automate your savings. The 403B, the money's automatically taken out of your paycheck. So what if you do that with your checking account? So you go through and you create this budget, you get $10 here, you get $15 there. It doesn't sound like much, right? Course of 5 years adds up to a lot of money. And I have one other big thought. For all of us that are in a similar situation, invest in your career, invest in your skills, invest in your education, because that's where you really make a lot of your money anyway, and that's where your mind gets engaged, and that's where you can get a huge return on effort. So you may not have a lot of financial wealth, but you have a lot of mental and moral wealth. Invest in that, and it'll pay off.
Sounds doable to me.
And it sounds like fun, too.
It does. Well, unfortunately, though, that is all the time we've got for Getting Personal this week. But if you're trying to make a dramatic change in your patterns, or even just a simple one, we'd love to try to help. And just another reminder to all the thousands of men and women serving in the military, their veterans and their families, we want to get your financial questions. We're going to be dedicating an entire hour to this issue next month. So give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And now we're answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
You're welcome, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. In a down economy, classic tends to make a comeback. Sleek Eames chairs, Jackie O style suits. The right antique or vintage buys can actually beat inflation. And that selling point appeals to Marketplace's Eve Tro.
Its name is Ektorp. It's big, it's orange, it's a couch that costs $500 at IKEA. To you, it's something to sit on. To antique dealer Chris Jussel, it's
something that depreciates almost 100% immediately.
He says new furniture is like a new car. Drive it off the lot, the value tanks. He says antiques are more like stocks. Get in when the market's down, like it is now, and you could see a payoff in the future. Jessel's seen more young couples curious about antiques venturing into his auction house, Samuel Freeman, in Philadelphia. Their eyes go wide.
Oh, golly, I can buy something that's actually old and might eventually be worth something for the same or less expensive than they're going to find at places like IKEA and Crate and Barrel.
He says classic items that have maintained their price for years are going at auction for 50% less than they were 6 months ago. You think retail is priced to move? Try families who need to unload heirlooms fast.
What you see are the three Ds, the death, divorce, distress.
Yeah, I like it.
At an estate sale in Los Angeles, Naj Malouli and Jason Arnold move a table for a better view.
We're looking at this teak table.
1960s modernist table. It's beautiful, it's curvaceous.
This type of table sells online for more than $400.
I don't want to pay more than $100 for it.
Malouli got her price. The seller's house is in foreclosure. I recently entered the fold of antique bargain hunters. When I moved to a new apartment, I went to Craigslist for furniture. Under vintage, I saw a lot of junk, then a great mid-century modern couch. Same price as IKEA's Ektorp, $500. It's low-slung, bright blue with one long padded cushion for the seat and another long cushion across the back. The dark wood frame holds this cool built-in table, black glass. I asked antique expert Chris Jessel if I made a good buy.
Actually, when you described it, your voice went up and you talked about it with a great deal of passion. You know what it's worth because you know what you paid for it, don't you?
That made me feel good, but here's something else about Jessel. He was the first host of the TV hit Antiques Roadshow. He knows value. And later, I couldn't resist. I emailed a photo of the couch, it's at marketplace.org, and asked what it might be worth, in dollars. The upper end of his estimate was twice what I paid. Yes! That created a monster. Suddenly, I was curious about what kind of money I could get for my kitchen table, my bedside lamp, my old Girl Scout uniform, badges and all. Apparently, that's a common urge right now.
People are now looking at, what do I have of value?
Elizabeth Mason runs the Paper Bag Princess. It's a designer vintage store in Beverly Hills. She says even if they have no intention to sell, people want to know if, in a pinch, they could liquidate their closet to pay the bills. She's getting more calls to appraise clients' wardrobes.
People are also looking at their clothing as a way to make money.
On my visit, I just happened to wear something of my grandmother's, a necklace, silver with blue stones. Mason took a closer look.
I'd put it somewhere in the 40s, and this looks like it's lapis, but most importantly, it looks great on. What price would I put on that? Probably $600 or $700.
Really? Hands off my necklace, lady. Knowing the market value changes the way I see things. I smile a little more when I fasten my grandma's choker or settle into my couch. Since I actually use them, they're not really investments, but they could be later on down the line. As dealer Chris Jussel says about the appeal of the Antiques Roadshow, it's all about potential.
The possibility of going into your attic and winning the lottery.
And you may just decide to sit on or wear that lottery ticket instead of cashing it in. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Troh for Marketplace Money.
Last weekend, we talked to our own Bob Moon about proposals for nationalizing banks in this country. Basically, Uncle Sam would become the CEO of a number of troubled banks. Well, the solution du jour, or at least du week, is now something called a bad bank. And you're likely to hear that term a lot over the next week. I think we can all agree the industry needs a spanking, but we wondered exactly what purpose a bad bank would serve. So we went to Marketplace senior editor Patty Hirsch.
Well, let me answer that with an example. One I like is the old Victorian story about the family with a crazy old uncle. This old uncle is giving them problems, so they take him and they put him in an asylum. And that's really what a bad bank is. It's a bank is taking the stuff that it doesn't want, it's locking it away in a box, and it's keeping its fingers crossed.
Essentially, the government would go out and buy all the stuff that banks don't want on their books. and hold on to it in a separate bad bank. But Patty says there are a couple of big issues to consider.
Firstly, this is taxpayer money that we're talking about. We don't know how much or how bad they're going to be down the line, so we don't know how big the bill is going to be. I mean, they're talking about between $1 and $2 trillion. It could conceivably become a lot bigger than that.
And the downsides don't end there.
How do you actually value these assets? You know, the government's going to have to go out and say, well, we think this mortgage-backed security is worth this amount. And there's going to be a negotiation. Either the taxpayer is going to get ripped off because we're paying too much for these securities, or the bank's going to get hammered because it's going to be paying too little, which means it then has to write down the value of all those other like securities.
And what if your mortgage is one of the ones that ends up inside the bad bank?
The great thing about this is that it gives the government carte blanche to go and deal with those loans itself. So the government could then say, well, let's help you out with that loan, Mr. Homeowner. We'll help you find a repayment schedule. We'll adjust the interest rate.
Patty tells us the other upside is that with all that bad stuff taken off the bank's books, those toxic assets we hear so much about, banks could start acting like banks again.
And that's going to allow them to go on and do what they do best, which is to make savings and loans and help people with their investments. And that's going to hopefully reinvigorate the economy down the line. The crazy uncle could, in fact, have a complete recovery.
If that analogy just wasn't enough for you, Patty's got a longer explanation in one of his whiteboard videos on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, there's a first time for everything, and that includes filing for unemployment.
The first few days, I kept telling everybody I was signing up for the dole and making kind of a joke about it, but really, I'm pretty down about it.
Marketplace Money's producers include Stephen Hoffman, Eve Tro, and Allison Gilbert. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yorb. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tessa Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com/new offers.
American Public Media.